ATD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be taken into a world that most of us know very, very little about. We're going into the world of the 1% or the 0.01%, the wealthiest people in America. Blythe Grossberg, my guest in the morning show, has known a number of them and even known better their children, because she worked for many, many years in New York City as a tutor and learning specialist for the children of some of these extremely wealthy Americans, and has written a fascinating memoir about her experiences called I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. It's a fascinating book. And by the way, she has a number of other books to her credit, books that are a bit different, that spring directly out of her experience and expertise in working with young people on the spectrum. So she's written several highly regarded books about, for instance, Asperger's or ADHD, and maybe 9 or 10 books altogether. This one, a little more personal in nature, published by Hanover Square Press, again titled I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. Blythe Grossberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's good to be here.
I really loved this book. It was so very, very interesting. Can you maybe tell our listeners what prompted you to sit down and write this? Did anything in particular prompt you to want to tell this particular story and write a book so different from the other books you've written?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I am originally from a town in central Massachusetts, and I spent a number of years, as you said, living in New York City, tutoring and teaching a range of kids, including those in the top probably 0.01%. And then I eventually moved back to the Boston area, and I would kind of regale people with some of these stories of, you know, the families I'd worked with in New York. And they said, you know, they kind of were incredulous. I mean, they couldn't believe some of these stories. And they said, you should write a book about that. But it was also just my own attempt to kind of put these years into some kind of focus or order and kind of share my experiences. And I think, you know, as I started writing, I really connected what I experienced to larger themes regarding equality, education, the very affluent. And, you know, so I think while it is a memoir, it calls in a lot of these larger themes that I wanted to write about.
Right. It's also a book about you and about how you felt stepping into the lives of these people who were had, in some cases, almost unimaginable wealth, and were living lives so different from your own life. One of the most intriguing moments in the book, when you touch on this, is when you actually utilize the word shame. You write at one point, in terms of kind of talking about what it was like to work with these children whose parents, in some cases, were making 10 times the money you made, and maybe more. You said, I continue to feel, above all things, shame. It's interesting that I don't feel outraged that teachers aren't paid better. Instead, I feel hopelessly left behind, unable to keep up, and fearful of being exposed. Can you tell us more about that sense of shame that at least at some points you felt? And did that get better over time, or was that rather persistent?
Yeah, I have spent some time thinking about that kind of word, shame, too, because, you know, in that situation in which I found out that the average income at the private school where I worked in New York was $750,000 a year, I was so taken aback. And I guess I fell into the trap that I think a lot of us fall into, of wanting to be like, you know, the 0.01%, or feeling like I should be like them. And, you know, I consciously chose professions that are about other things aside from, you know, making money. They're about connecting with people and helping people. But I still think we live in a kind of society where wealth is very championed, and where, you know, people who don't have as much money might feel ashamed. I think it's a common reaction to being around people who have so much. And, you know, there were many moments when I felt, especially going into these people's houses, that I just could never even hope to emulate, or, you know, I wouldn't even say catch up, because we weren't really in the same race. But it is, I think, you know, the world, that kind of world also inspires a lot of competition. So even, you know, I am a very privileged person, and, you know, as I write the book, I've been privileged to have a lot of education too. But, you know, that's what kind of made it interesting, is in a world like that, you know, I felt ashamed of what I had. And I can only imagine other people in that world, such as kids who come from different backgrounds and attend private schools on scholarship, and how they must feel.
Right.
So I think I think that feeling was somewhat continual.
What's interesting, though, is that it becomes abundantly clear that you in no way really envied the lives that these people were living. At one point, you call them sort of collectively the fretful on Fifth Avenue, because of the perpetual sort of angst that was a part of their lives. I mean, there was no sense of contentment, on resting on one's laurels, of sort of taking a deep breath. They were leading lives riddled with stress, and so were their children, by and large. Tell us more about the evidence that you saw of that on a nearly daily basis.
Sure. So, yes, as you say, over time, I began to not seek to emulate this extremely wealthy group of people at all. And part of the reason for that was just the frenetic, frenzied pace with which they led their lives. And, you know, they really like to stuff their children's and their family's schedules with full of as many events and things as possible. So the kids, for example, sometimes would have private sports lessons, such as on the squash court at 5 or 6 in the morning before school. And then, you know, after school, they'd get whisked away by private car to go to their, you know, back to squash lessons or tennis lessons or whatever they were. And then, you know, a lot of the kids' schedules were really booked with not only sports, but also tutors. I mean, I had met kids who had tutors in every single subject. So, you know, their rooms were just these hives of activity, where tutors came and went. And, you know, that only intensified when the kids approached, 11th grade or 12th grade and had to take the SAT or ACT to get into college. And, you know, in addition, their schools are pretty demanding academically. So these kids were not the kinds of kids who had a lot of time to relax, and were kids who were pretty much driven to constant activity, and, you know, didn't have a lot of the, kind of comforts and just, you know, fun moments of childhood.
You write at one point, when I first started working at New York City private schools, I was taken aback by the parents' anger and angst. But now I understand the entire lifetime that has brought them to this point. We're speaking with Blythe Grossberg, talking about her memoir, I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. That subtitle refers to the 1% in terms of wealth in this country. You were part of what you term at one point the tutoring industry in Manhattan, and it is a robust industry. In other words, there is a huge demand, I mean, that really outstrips the supply for tutors like yourself. Can you kind of describe that so-called tutoring industry for us and sort of how it's set up or how it operates?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the tutoring industry is, there are parts of it that are really positive in that, you know, there are great reading tutors or reading specialists, for example, or learning specialists who really try to help kids acquire better skills and, you know, eventually work towards independence. And then there are a lot of tutors who, you know, often in New York, they are struggling actors or actresses or musicians or writers. And they're not, you know, they're very bright, they're academic, and they're just not able to make enough money in the gig economy. So they turn to tutoring. And, you know, some, and in particular, I write about the tutors who work on the SAT and ACT, because some of them charge really exorbitant rates. And I'm talking about probably close to $1,000 an hour now.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in New York, it was 800, but that was 2 years ago. And, you know, they might have all attended an Ivy League school, for example, and, you know, gotten very high scores on these tests. It is, at a certain point, I could not figure out what these people who charge, you know, $800 an hour are doing differently than people who charge less than a quarter of what they charge. And, you know, I think the problem is that it just added a lot of stress to the kids' lives in that, you know, some of these tutoring companies will ask them to do a lot of expensive preparation for the tests and taking full-length tests every weekend. And then, you know, the kids didn't even have time to dedicate to their schoolwork, which was more important than the SAT or ACT. And, you know, I think the problem is some of these tutors kind of work in isolation. They don't really understand the other stresses on the kids' lives. And I think the other problem is that kids kind of learn not to do anything on their own. You know, the best kind of tutoring will help them promote their own independence, but there's a lot of tutoring where they just become dependent on the tutor. And, you know, some kids even have to get tutored through college because their grades are really good, in part because they've received a lot of tutoring, and then they'll go to a college that's too difficult for them, and then they'll have to, get tutored through college. But, you know, I think the hard thing is it's kind of like an arms race. So, you know, once one person starts hiring a tutor, everybody else wants to, you know, be in that same situation and have the same advantages. So I don't think the situation is going away anytime soon.
Right. And it's interesting when you describe, I mean, for all of the sort of shame or embarrassment that you sometimes felt in terms of being a relatively humble person stepping into these arenas of extreme privilege, that nonetheless, many of these families saw you as a savior. I mean, that's a really interesting position. I mean, where you are far beneath them in socioeconomic terms, and yet they are seeing you as a savior, essential to the success of their children. I want to ask you about something earlier in that same chapter when you talk about that, when you talk about the relationship that you had with many of these young people with whom you worked. You write, "These kids are not my kids, and I don't think of them that way, but I think of them as friends, as younger siblings, perhaps. and I feel that I can change their lives just a bit, as they can change mine. Is that also something that was fairly consistent through the course of these years that you did this? Or only over time did you figure that out, that that was the best kind of relationship to foster?
No, I mean, I think that was pretty consistent. And, you know, I often came home and, you know, I kind of likened myself to a welcome back Potter, you know, and I would just tell my husband about all these kids and, you know, their stories, and they kind of became part of our lives. And, you know, I write about in the book times when I was really worried about them. You know, for example, the boy who lived it by himself virtually in a hotel room with his, you know, parents and younger brother down the hallway. I mean, that to me seemed very problematic. So, you know, I think it was impossible at a certain point to work so closely with the kids and not feel, you know, touched by them and just worried about them at times. But, you know, it was, I think with any education, there is kind of an emotional component to it. And I think, you know, any teacher would tell you that too, is, you know, over time you really get to know your students and you realize that they're only going to learn from you if you have a kind of rapport with them. So, you know, learning is not a kind of a cold clinical thing. It's really part of, you know, a friendship, in a way. And, you know, that's what I realized. But, you know, I also felt, I don't want to say I felt sympathy for them, but, you know, I felt some of their stresses and, you know, I had to kind of acknowledge those stresses and help them sometimes with them in order to even, you know, do what I was supposed to do in terms of academic work.
Right. Well, and I think it's fair to say that you did feel out and out sympathy, at least for some of these young people, in terms of what their their parents were putting them through. I love the way you open chapter 3 called Creating Harmony when you write, learning is more relational and less purely cognitive than most people think. If kids like you, they are going to do the work most of the time. I learned that the tutoring relationship is all about creating harmony between the student and me. And that's really interesting. Would you say that that is distinct from the relationship between, for instance, a classroom teacher and her students? Does there need to be a different relationship between a tutor and someone that they are tutoring?
I think so. I think it's just that a tutor has a lot of advantages because, you know, we only work with one or two students at a time. So we can really customize what we do and the kinds of, you know, learning that we offer. And in the book, I talk a lot about metaphors in terms of framing how I'm helping the kids and the work they're doing. And one of my goals is always to find kind of the metaphor or the language that will work with the kid in front of me. So, you know, if they're really interested in sports, then I can use, you know, a sports metaphor about having to do drills and, you know, practice their three-point shot or whatever it is. And they usually respond better if you kind of just frame things in their terms. So for me, a lot of it was getting to know, and still is in my work, getting to know the student, their interests, what motivates them, and kind of using that in my work because, you know, they vary so much in terms of what would actually motivate them to learn.
A really fascinating moment in the book is when you are talking about a young man named Alex that you tutored, and I'm sure you've changed all of these names, but his is a, you know, kind of a complicated story. But at one point you describe this about Alex. Though Alex lives in the most dynamic city in the world, his world is small, and he interacts in very limited ways with the people of New York. Rather than going out to the city has throughout his life come to him in the form of baby nurses, nannies, housekeepers, cleaners, tutors, chefs, coaches, trainers, and others who visit them at home. His home is his world, and the private school he attends is a home away from home, a secluded place that is similarly upscale. I'm sure that's not exactly the way it plays out for all of these privileged young people. But it's interesting to think about somebody being incredibly wealthy or in an incredibly healthy household having a small world. Because I think most of us from the outside looking in imagine that the whole world is available to them, and in a sense it is. But that doesn't mean that that's what they get to experience.
Yeah, I think for a lot of these kids, they kind of grow up in a bubble because partly their parents are very protective. And partly I feel like a lot of their parents didn't venture out that much from their neighborhoods in Manhattan. So, you know, if they lived on the Upper East Side, that's where they stayed. Or if they lived on the West Side, that's where they stayed, except for occasional trips to the East Side. So, you know, I, at times when I was living in New York, lived in different neighborhoods in Brooklyn and then in Queens. And, you know, people would, from this top 0.01%, would ask me where I lived, and they wouldn't even really know what I was talking about. And it was their city, you know. So I think very, very wealthy people in New York sometimes have found a way to kind of go around the city, in that they also don't tend to use public transportation as much as everyone else has to. And, you know, they, some do. I mean, you see people going down to Wall Street in the morning on the subway, but some don't. And they have their personal drivers who, you know, drive them around, and drive them to school. And they just don't interact with the city the same way someone else might. And I think it's really different. You know, in the morning on the way to work, I would see different kinds of kids take the subway, some of whom were very young. And this is, of course, in the pre-pandemic days. And I think, you know, the average New York City kid is very much, you know, aware of what's going on the streets, on the subway, in different neighborhoods. And the kids I work with really, to some degree, weren't. So, you know, I talk about one boy who kind of, you know, goes under this aqueduct and gets mugged. And, you know, he just wasn't aware of his surroundings, you know, that it probably wasn't best to walk alone under this protective covering. And, you know, a lot of the kids, and, you know, I talk about another boy who goes into a kind of bodega or little store in Brooklyn and orders a bagel and cream cheese for $2 and tries to pay with his dad's gold card, you know, and they didn't accept credit cards. And he kind of invited some snickers from, you know, meeting some laughs from, you know, the people around in the store. So, you know, I think to some degree the kids don't know their own city very well, partly because their parents haven't shown it to them.
Right. This comes up in a later chapter in which you open by kind of returning to the whole matter of getting into the most prestigious of universities and the college admission scandal that all of us have heard about. In this chapter where you kind of talk about this, you touch on the Common App essay that in many cases these young people have to write, an essay, maximum of 650 words, a blank canvas, a chance to tell the colleges something that is not apparent about you from the other parts of the application, an open-ended personal statement. You tell us that many of these incredibly wealthy young people struggle terribly with what to write. And you write, the obstacle is that these kids have not been able to experience moments of epiphany because every minute has been scheduled for them. These kids have not had time to wander.
Yeah, I think that was an interesting experience in that, as you said, I work with so many kids who really struggled with what to write about. And, you know, some kids, it's more common, you know, for kids to have a lot of ideas, I think, and, you know, maybe struggle to find the right one. But these kids had, they just couldn't come up with anything. And I think it points to the fact that a lot of their lives have been kind of prepackaged and like pre-digested for them. So, you know, even if they did travel, some of them traveled, but they would travel in a very like luxurious way where they wouldn't really see that much, I think, sometimes of the countries they went to. Or, you know, they would travel for sports. So, for example, one boy, you know, went to Egypt years ago to play squash, but like that was all he did. He didn't really see anything in Egypt. So, you know, he might as well have been in suburban Connecticut playing squash. So, you know, I think when it comes to really like an open canvas, a blank canvas, such as, you know, what the Common App asks kids to write to get into college, they really don't know how to formulate what's important about them or what they really want in any kind of like genuine way. And of course, there are exceptions to this and kids who have a lot of passion and, you know, that's great. But it is pretty common, I think, on the other hand, to find kids who have no idea what interests them or who they are. And, you know, to some degree, it is hard to write this essay when you're 17 years old because you haven't experienced a lot of life. But I think kids who are thrown out more in the world, maybe unfortunately or fortunately, you know, just have a lot more life experience and a lot more kind of sense of who they are than some of these kids that I worked with.
Right. And in many cases, these kids you worked with have not been allowed to chart their own course. I mean, everything has been laid out and so scripted. You do say at one point in the book, this, meaning this book, I think, is not meant to be an indictment of those with more. I mean, and you certainly dealt with kind-hearted, compassionate people who maybe broke some of the stereotypes we have about the extremely wealthy. That being said, you did see again and again certain things that were troubling, and one of them, that those who have higher socioeconomic status expect to get away with more, and that sometimes they would have expectations, a sense of entitlement, that they should be given things because they are wealthy and privileged. Is that, I mean, it feels like that aligns with the stereotype that a lot of us have about the people who are at the very, very top of the economic pyramid in this country. Did you see many exceptions to that, or by and large, was that pretty pervasive?
I saw a lot of exceptions to that. I mean, I saw parents who, you know, for example, maybe they were people of great means, but then they knew, you know, some of their child's friends didn't have as much, and they would be extremely generous, you know, not to make the other child feel bad. I mean, up until the point of inviting them on vacation, you know, to go to travel with the family, or offering a place for, you know, a kid to stay who was maybe troubled in his or her own family. So, you know, I saw wonderful examples, and, you know, a lot of the parents were dedicated to activism. They were dedicated to making society more equitable. But like all parents, they sometimes drew the line at their own kids. And I think, you know, that's a natural parental instinct. But, you know, they essentially at times, even while they could be incredibly generous to other people, were doing things like resource hoarding for their own children, you know, and perhaps they didn't see the two things in conflict with each other, or perhaps they just thought, you know, this is what I need to do as a parent. But, you know, there were times in which, you know, their own kind of stated beliefs, or maybe their actions in one arena of their life, which were kind of more equitable and charitable, would contradict what they did with their own children.
Interesting. And of course, again and again, you write about how fear seemed to be such a central motivation for so many of these parents. I mean, just desperate to give their children each and every possible advantage. And sometimes, you know, to an extent that just sort of boggled the imagination. A last question, I know you need to go. How much do you miss this world and this this kind of work that you were doing? I'm assuming that, I mean, I know you have moved away from New York City now, you and your family, and I assume that you are not sort of dealing with this sort of stratus of society, at least to the same extent that you were. Are there things about it that you very much miss?
I miss a lot about New York. I think first and foremost, the pizza. which, you know, as a tutor running around the city, I would mainly eat pizza because it was cheap and fast. And, you know, the pizza in Boston is, excuse me, not the same as the pizza in New York. But I love New York. I just love, like, how vibrant it is. And, you know, I, to some degree, you know, I have some very fond memories of it. You know, but I also like being here in Boston where, you know, it's a little bit calmer. And, you know, there's sort of more, I think, a New England ethic of doing things for yourself, which I definitely appreciate. So, you know, I think some of my values are a little more attuned with the values of New England, such as education and, you know, the importance of education. But yeah, New York, there is no other place like New York. And, you know, I do, I thank the people I worked with all these years because they gave me such great stories.
Right.
But, and they were, you know.
Yeah, but do you miss that work? Do you miss working with those kind of young people or not particularly?
Well, I still work with, you know, people who are pretty privileged. And I think New York is the most, you know, steroidal city. But I think, you know, some of these themes that I talk about are true in almost every affluent community, you know, just this idea of academic pressure and maybe parents tending to privilege academic success over emphasizing some other things like integrity. I think that's something that's very common. So, you know, it's not just in New York. I think it's toned down a little bit elsewhere. New York, as I said, is the most steroidal example of it. But yeah, I think, you know, anytime you're working with children from a certain strata, there are certain commonalities, I think.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and you've given us a peek into really a fascinating world that on the one hand we might envy to some extent, and on the other hand draw back from in maybe even horror at certain cases. The book again is I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%, published by Hanover Square Press, the author Blythe Grossberg. Blythe Grossberg, thank you so much for writing this really remarkable book, and thank you for being part of the Morning Show today. I'm so glad we got to have this conversation.
Thank you, Greg. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. My apologies for those technical difficulties. Here is part two of today's morning show, already in progress, talking with the author of a series of mysteries called A to Z.
And so I try to put myself in their shoes. And I remember something that I think it was Roald Dahl, the author, once was asked. He was asked, what do kids like? And he said, they like danger, they like chocolate, and they like... Great question. Any writer for children needs to, in my opinion, put himself into the shoes of someone in his audience. My audience is 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, and so I try to put myself in their shoes. And I remember something that I think it was Roald Dahl, the author, once was asked. He was asked, what do kids like? And he said, they like danger, they like chocolate, and they like alligators. So when I'm writing, I try to keep in mind what do kids like and what do they want to read about. And, of course, they love a good mystery, and they love to put the bad guy behind bars. So those are the things I keep in the front of my mind, and I'm always writing through the eyes of an 8-year-old. I try to keep the language that they would use without being snarky or sarcastic. My books have no violence in them at all, and no swear words, thank you. But I just always try to keep my reader in mind, would this fly with the average 8-year-old?
Right. I'm so glad you mentioned the matter of no violence, because I confess I've not read all of your books, but I have had the pleasure of reading some of them to get a sense of what you do. And one would not immediately say about a given book, there's no violence here. And I think some books that studiously avoid violence, you really it's done in a very sort of self-conscious way, and what's there on the page is, in a sense, kind of limp and tepid and safe. And I like the fact that there is plenty of intensity, sometimes even jeopardy. But you're right, no violence. Is that kind of a tricky thing to craft these books where they are still exciting, even though you don't have the otherwise sort of easy tool of violence on hand?
Almost the opposite, Greg. If for me to write any kind of violence into written material would be a stretch, because I'm a nonviolent person. I cannot imagine striking another person, even though when I do my own reading, my adult reading, I do read murder mysteries.
The, the matter of no violence, because I mean, I confess I've not read all of your books, but I have had the pleasure of reading some of them to get a sense of what you do. And one would not immediately say about a given book, there's no violence here. And I think some books that studiously avoid violence, you really it's done in a very sort of self-conscious way. And what's there on the page is, in a sense, kind of limp and tepid and safe. And I like the fact that there is plenty of intensity, sometimes even jeopardy. But you're right, no violence. Is that kind of a tricky thing to craft these books where they are still exciting, even though you don't have the otherwise sort of easy tool of violence on hand?
Almost the opposite, Greg. If for me to write any kind of violence into written material would be a stretch, because I'm a nonviolent person. I cannot imagine striking another person. Even though when I do my own reading, my adult reading, I do read murder mysteries and there is violence. But for kids, there's no place for violence. There's no place for hitting. And I've received over the years thousands and thousands of emails from parents and librarians who say, thank goodness these books are safe for my kids to read. And I don't have to worry that they're going to read something that's going to be ugly or violent. So that's been my little banner that I've been waving all these many years. No violence, no bad words, just fun and, as you say, some jeopardy.
Right. So tell us about the decision that you have made to allow what you have created, I mean, these A to Z mysteries, to be transformed into a podcast. Tell us about the first conversations that occurred around that possibility, and were you immediately and excitedly open to that possibility, or were you, I mean, understandably wary of the possibility?
Well, I am not a podcast person. I don't listen to them. I'm more visual. I read. So when Pina approached me through my literary agent in New York City, I was a little bit mystified. So because I didn't get the concept at first. But I did some research and talked with some friends who are more groovy than I am. And I thought, oh, this is a great idea. This is getting my stories out to kids who sit in the back seat of the car and they listen to a podcast. The audio books have certainly helped. Diverging for just a second, a couple of years ago, South Korea decided that they needed more tools to help their children learn to speak English. So they bought the whole series, A to Z Mysteries, in audio so they could use them in the classroom in South Korea. And that's so thrilling. And the podcast is just another extension of that for me, just getting the stories out there, entertaining kids, teaching them something, I hope, without being didactic, and it's all good. It's all good. It's and more stuff is coming. We think there might be a movie down the line or a TV series. Very thrilling.
Wow. So Maggie McGuire, entrusted with this franchise, if you will, of the A to Z Mysteries. I'm sure you obviously took this responsibility very seriously. What are some of the things that you thought about with your team in terms of making this a worthy vehicle for what Ron Roy had already created on the page?
Oh, Greg, that's such a great question, and you are right. We hold this franchise and all of Ron's works and stories, you know, very carefully in our hands as we thought about how would we bring A to Z Mysteries to life in a podcast form and ensure that it's unique and different than an audiobook experience that kids might have and the reading experience. What can we do differently? And one of the things that, you know, Pinna intentionally thinks about when we're thinking about bringing a podcast to life for kids is how will we activate our listeners in a new way? So what is, how does that translate into our podcast that we collaborated on with John? We really thought about, hey, Dink, Josh, and Ruth Rose, who are the key characters in the A to Z Mysteries who solve mysteries, how do we bring our listeners into the club? Really create an environment where our listeners are actively helping to solve the mystery or the clues or the problems along the way with our three main characters. And so one of the things that we did that this podcast does differently is we break the fourth wall. Really, at moments throughout the podcast, as Dink, Josh, and Ruth Rose are getting their arms around the latest Green Lawn mystery, they turn to our listener and they say, hey, Clue Club, help us. And we built in some different audio cues that if you're a listener to the podcast, you quickly sort of tune into and understand that there are sound cues that let you know there's probably a clue to be paying attention to. And the listening experience becomes incredibly immersive when you think that these characters who you've loved in the stories Ron has written are now inviting you into their club to help solve the mystery. And so, we believe that that is a unique and different way to engage the listener and to engage kids. And then certainly we were so excited to have the opportunity to craft with Ron and his team new stories. So the podcast, we just launched season 3 today on Pinna, and there's a whole cast of new stories that kids can tune into that they can't find in print. So
this is May.